The London Underground can be a very eerie place, especially at night. You have to descend down hundreds of steps to reach the belly of the city. And as you do so, you begin to feel very vulnerable, very alone. And as the trains rush through the tunnels, they blow stale, sooty currents of air all around you. Your hair whips across your face, and your eyes sting with a dry mixture of dust, pollution, and city grime. The trains scream as they fly to the platform. It's a horrible cry of metal on metal, crunching brakes and flickering lights. However, there's a story that flows through the underground just as swiftly as the train. It's the story of a woman traveling alone at night, standing on the platform, coat pulled tight around her shoulders. She can't stop her mind from wandering to dark places, as we all have done. We've all had the horrible thought of, what if I did it? What if I just jumped in front of this moving train? Or, what would I do if I got on the train with a madman? Or, what would happen if this train derailed, trapping me in the pitch-black tunnel 100 feet below London town? The call of the void is like a siren, singing sweetly to the woman while she waits for her train. When the train arrives, it pulls the woman from her grim fantasy. Hitching her backpack high on her shoulders, she scans the empty carriage for a good place to sit. Halfway down the carriage is a sharply dressed middle-aged man reading the Evening Standard. Neither of them acknowledge one another. This is London. We don't chat, make eye contact, or even recognize each other's existence. We are far more comfortable in our own anonymity. The woman chooses a seat opposite from the man farther down the carriage. She would have preferred an empty carriage, but this man seems okay, and he's adhering to the unspoken London social contract. The train speeds off to the next station, another shrill wail and forceful stop as it approaches the platform. The woman pulls out her book. She has perfected the art of reading on trains, and there's no reason to reach for one's phone, for there isn't any signal or internet underground. The next stop approaches with a howl and a scream, the train doors beeping as they open. Two men enter the carriage, a woman held tightly in between them. They sit directly opposite the woman. This makes her instantly uncomfortable. It's a near empty carriage. A proper Londoner would never sit directly across from her on an empty train. But something about this trio doesn't feel right. The men are stoic, dark-eyed and threatening. The woman between them is limp, drooping, and seems to be propped up by her male suitors. Like a good Londoner, she keeps her eyes averted, focused on her book. But she can feel eyes fixated upon her. She glances at the men, but they are both focused forward, watching the tunnel rush past the train windows. Then, she takes a glance at the woman. Her face is drawn, gray and haunting. But what's most unsettling is her eyes, wide, glassy, and focused directly upon her. The woman becomes startled. Gasping, she drops her book, and her mind races. All of a sudden, the sharp-dressed man from down the carriage is by her side. He's handing her her book and saying, "Oh, it's so good to see you. It's been ages." The woman's very confused. The man leans in for a hug, and as he embraces her stunned body, he whispers, "If you know what's good for you, you'll get off at the next stop with me." The woman is baffled, frightened, and as the train pulls into the next station, she allows the sharply dressed man to lead her out of the carriage. As she stands on the platform, dazed and confused, the man sits her down on a bench. He informs her that he's a doctor here in the city, and he came to her because he noticed that the woman sitting across from her on the train was deceased. The woman's head is spinning, thousands of questions filling her mind. She asks him, "How did you know? Because you're a doctor?" "No," replies the man, "because I saw a pair of scissors stuck in the back of her skull." Kyle told me this story one night as the two of us rode in an empty carriage on the Piccadilly line. And I know it's true, because Kyle's brother told him the story, and his friend's cousin's partner knew the lady who was saved by the doctor. Hello and welcome to the season one finale of The West London Witch, a podcast where we share stories about those moments where we find ourselves very much not alone. Growing up in the 90s, I lived on a steady diet of Goosebumps, So Weird, and my favorite, Are You Afraid of the Dark? I used to read and watch anything spooky that I could get my hands on. I thought that the Midnight Society was so cool. A group of besties that meet up in the woods to swap scary stories, not to mention the awesome glitter sand they threw into the bonfire before the start of each story. I loved every creepy minute of it. That is, until bedtime. My mind raced as I recounted all the gruesome details of the tales. My mom ended up putting a moratorium on all things spooky, but I loved it, and I'd happily swap a sleepless night for a good scary story. So, in celebration of the conclusion of our first season, I have brought the Midnight Society to you. Today, we have a collection of urban legends and hometown horror stories for you. Is everyone seated comfortably? Submitted for the approval of the Midnight Society, I'm Rebecca Strazina, and this is The West London Witch, Season 1 Finale. I know it's true. A friend of a friend told me so. Our first submission tonight into the Midnight Society comes to us from Zoe, from the Stories of Strangeness podcast. She takes us to the beautiful counties of East Anglia. Roaming the stunning countryside and the shores of the North Sea is a creature so legendary that he has been terrifying the locals since the 16th century.
I grew up on a farm in the fens of East Anglia, right where the counties of Norfolk, Suffolk, and Cambridgeshire meet. Out in the fens, the land is so flat you can see for miles, right to the horizon. The sky takes up half of our world. Being out in the countryside makes for an amazing sunrise or glorious sunset, but it also means that when the sun sets, it gets dark. I don't mean struggle to see dark. I mean you can't see your hand in front of your face dark. There are no streetlights, no passing traffic, and very few houses. Growing up, we always made sure to be home before dark, but not just because of the darkness, but because of what might be waiting for us in it. And it's not just the darkness. It's the noises, or sometimes the silence, that can creep up on you. Sound travels in the fens, so you can never really be sure of where the noises are actually coming from. It was a wonderful place to grow up, and I was lucky enough to have parents who liked to tell stories and had an interest in local myths and legends. But my favourite story was of Black Shook, the black dog of East Anglia. He had burning red eyes and wandered old farm roads just like those I would walk as a child. My parents told me if I ever saw him, it meant I was out too late and I should probably make my way home. But that didn't stop my sister and I going out to look for him. It wasn't until I was older that I researched him more, and this is what I found. The most famous Blackshook tale happened in Norfolk, 1577, in the picturesque towns of Bungay and Blythburgh. On Sunday the 4th of August, a terrible electric storm gripped the area. Hail and ball lightning fell upon the townsfolk, as terrified by this ungodly storm, they made their way to their parish church to seek shelter and reassurance. It was St. Mary's Church in Bungay that Blackshook visited first. With a crash of thunder and lightning, the demonic hound burst through the doors. He ran the length of the church, through its congregation, with unnatural speed and strength. He viciously snapped and mauled, and in another flash, he was gone. The hound left the parishioners dead and dying. Two bodies are said to have been found kneeling at prayer, their necks broken at odd angles. The condition of another body is said to have been shriveled, like an old leather purse. In Blythburgh, it is written that with an almighty crash and a flash of lightning, the doors of the Church of the Holy Trinity were thrown open as the storm hit with full force. In that same instant, struck by lightning, the church steeple collapsed in on itself. As the dust settled, standing in the doorway was the demonic hound, bigger than it had any right to be, eyes blazing. Blackshook ran through the terrified congregation, wreaking havoc, killing a man and a boy, and burning the hand of another, before it made its exit and disappeared back into the storm. The townsfolk were left in a state of terror, and Blackshook became a legend. Not all of the stories of Blackshook cast him as a demon dog. In some, he is just a loyal pet that continues after death to search for his master. There is a tale of two fishermen on the North Norfolk coast, one Danish and one Saxon, who went out fishing with their dog, but got into trouble and drowned. The Danishman was washed up in Beeston and the Saxon at Overstrand. Each was buried at the local church, but the dog who survived was unable to tell which grave was that of his master. So it is said that the loyal hound now roams between the two, searching for the master he was unable to save. He's been seen so many times in Overstrand, they've named a lane after him. So you see, the regional stories of Blackshook do vary. Some tell of a giant hound that is protective, a companion to those walking alone. Others say he is a portent of death, be it yours or a loved one's. Either way, it's his story that gripped me and inspired my love of all things supernatural. I look back at all the walks I went on as a child and I wonder what I would have done if I'd actually have seen something. And now, even as an adult, I still keep a lookout for him. But I'm not sure if I actually want to see him or not. But I like to think that maybe he's trotting along beside me.
Speaking of creatures following us into the night, Eric from Prairieland Paranormal Podcast shares with us his local horror story of Resurrection Mary.
So the legend of Resurrection Mary has all the common markers that you would think of for an urban legend. It includes a beautiful blonde, lost love, a lonely highway, tragedy, and a hitchhiking ghost. And like so many other urban legends, it's long-lived. It has been part of South Chicago lore for around 70 years, ever since the 1930s. According to the legend, Mary and her boyfriend were spending an evening at the O. Henry Ballroom. This was a very popular ballroom in the day. It's currently called the Willowbrook Ballroom, and it's just off of Archer Avenue in Willow Springs. In the 1930s, this was a very popular place. They had swing dancing, they had big bands, and they were known to book the best bands of the day, and it had a fairly bad reputation. It was secluded, it was known for booze and prostitution and gambling, and quite frankly, young people from the south side of Chicago, they flocked there. It was a very popular place. On this one night in particular, Mary and her boyfriend, they were at the ballroom. They were having a good time. They were dancing. They were drinking. But at some point, their evening turned into a fairly big blowout of an argument. Mary got mad. She left the ballroom and proceeded to walk home down Archer Avenue. As the legend goes, as Mary walked home that night, cold and alone, she was struck by a vehicle and a hit and run occurred, and she was left alone on the road to die. Mary's parents, grieving, they buried her in Resurrection Cemetery, and it's said that they buried her in her favorite white party dress. And it wasn't long until motorists driving up and down Archer Avenue started reporting a lot of weird things, particularly related to a young woman dressed in white standing on the side of the road. This woman would sometimes jump onto vehicles. There were reports of her jumping onto the rails on the side of older cars. There are also reports of her running into the street. People have struck her with their cars, only to find that she passes through the vehicle. There are also reports of her darting across the street and or flagging down motorists for a ride. Several people have stopped and offered Mary a ride.
What's so interesting about Resurrection Mary is that those who have encountered her all offer very similar retellings of their experiences.
She always asks to go down Archer Avenue, and she always asks them to stop at the gates of Resurrection Cemetery. When they stop at the gates, she mysteriously disappears, leaving the motorists shocked and in awe. There is one encounter with Mary that absolutely stands above all the rest, and this one is from 1939, and it's by a gentleman by the name of Jerry Paulus. Jerry Paulus was a young man during this time, and he was spending an evening at the Liberty Grove and Hall, which was another dance club and bar. While he was at the bar, he reports seeing a very attractive blonde sitting in the corner by herself. After some liquid courage and about an hour, he decided to approach her, and he asked her to dance. She agreed, and they spent the entire evening together, dancing and talking and late into the night. Jerry even reports that they spent some time smooching. As the club got to the point where it was closing down, the evening was coming to an end, they proceeded out into the parking lot where the woman asked Jerry for a ride home. He agreed, and she gave him an address on South Damon Avenue, and they headed off. As they were pulling away, the woman asked Jerry if he could take Archer Avenue, which was strange because it was kind of really out of the way, but Jerry says that he wanted to spend as much time as he could with this beautiful blonde, and he didn't care how long the trip home took. So he proceeded down Archer Avenue. As they approached Resurrection Cemetery, Jerry says that the woman told him to pull over, stating that she needed to get out here. Jerry was obviously confused, but there were some homes, some row houses, across the street from the cemetery, so he thought that she may have lived over there. So he proceeded to ask if he could walk her home. The woman told Jerry that where she was going, he could not come. He didn't understand this at the time, but she jumped out of the vehicle and ran towards the gates of Resurrection Cemetery. As she was running towards those gates, she vanished. Jerry was left on the side of the road like so many others, wondering what in the world just happened. The next day, Jerry decided to go ahead and go to the address that the woman had given him, and when he pulls up there, a woman answers the door but tells him that he could not have possibly spent the evening with her daughter because her daughter had been dead for 4 years.
The mother showed Paulus a photo of her deceased daughter, and he was horrified to realize that his mystery dream date was nothing more than a phantom.
This is by far one of the most popular tales of the legend of Resurrection Mary. But all of the tales of Resurrection Mary all seem to end very similarly, with the suitor for the evening left shocked and confused at the gates of Resurrection Cemetery after she disappears.
The majority of stories about Resurrection Mary come from the 1930s.
However, there was a strong resurgence of Resurrection Mary sightings in the 1970s.
Sightings of Resurrection Mary picked up again when the cemetery was undergoing some renovations. Locals assume that this is because her spirit became restless during this time. So if we jump to the 1970s, there are three prominent encounters in that decade. The first occurred in 1973 when a night manager at the Harlow's nightclub by the name of Bob Main says that Mary came into the club and spent two evenings there on two separate occasions. According to Main's account, this woman was very blonde and very pale, and she would come in and she would sit in the corner of the club all by herself. She would not speak to anyone, but she would occasionally get up and dance. But when she danced in a very weird kind of pirouette kind of style that kind of made people feel like she was really bizarre. Main says that he and his staff approached this woman several times, but her only interaction with them was to shake her head. She absolutely never spoke to anyone. Main asked his staff if anyone knew the woman, but no one knew her, and no one remembers carding her or actually letting her into the club or out of the club. Each time the woman appeared in the club, she mysteriously disappeared without a trace. The second encounter in the 1970s occurred in 1976. There were several reports one evening of a woman being locked in Resurrection Cemetery. Several passerbys claimed that they saw a woman standing at the gate with her hands on the gate, shaking it and screaming. Police were called. Police came and investigated it, but all they found were gates that were scorched and bent in the shape of hands. Now, the gates of Resurrection Cemetery are huge. They're very big. And over time, they've greened due to aging and oxidation. But over the years, these two spots have never oxidized. They were attracting so much attention and publicity that the city of Chicago actually had these bars cut out and replaced. The last big account of the 1970s occurred in 1976, and this was recorded in the Chicago Tribune. A cabbie by the name of Ralph is recorded in that article as stating that he dropped somebody off on Archer Avenue, and as he turned the corner, he spotted a young blonde woman standing on the corner with no coat on in the middle of a snowstorm. So being a good citizen, he stops and he asks if she needs any help. When he stops the cab, this woman jumps right into the front seat and asks him to proceed down Archer Avenue. As they're going down Archer Avenue, they're having very brief conversations with each other, mostly involving how the weather had changed so quickly and the snow had come early that year. As they get to Resurrection Cemetery, the woman screams, "Stop!" Ralph slams on his brakes and stops right at the gates of Resurrection Cemetery. Ralph is a little confused. He doesn't know exactly where the woman wants to go, so he says, "Where?" And he says that the woman pointed with her finger and said, "There," pointing to the cemetery. And according to Ralph's story, he says that that's when things got really weird. Without opening the door, the woman simply disappeared. Obviously, Ralph is left on the side of the road wondering what is going on.
These are just a small selection of Resurrection Mary sightings. There are countless stories of this beautiful blonde trying to make her way back to her final resting place in the historic cemetery.
Without a doubt, Resurrection Mary is the most seen ghost in the Windy City. So if you're feeling a little adventurous, if you're in the Windy City of Chicago, and you happen to find yourself along Archer Avenue, maybe you can head on down to Resurrection Cemetery and ask her yourself.
Our final submission to the Midnight Society comes to us from one of my dear friends, Jim Dale. Jim is a songwriter and the frontman for the band Goldheart Assembly, and is currently writing a book on the world's most influential pop rock band, the Beatles.
Much like Resurrection Mary, the beginning of this magical mystery tour all starts with a car crash.
So Paul is dead, legend, which Paul McCartney spoofed much later on in his career with an album called Paul is Live, which was quite nice. It started, the Beatles just had so many rumours about them anyway. So everyone was always looking for absolutely anything that they could get that would open up a bigger world of the Beatles. So they quite famously had a lot of fans who would camp outside each of the Beatles' homes, particularly Paul McCartney's home up in St. John's Wood. So they were always looking for something. I think there was a car crash on the M1 in like 1966, and some fans became a bit hysterical that Paul might have died. And they called up the Beatles' record label and management company to ask, and it was all fine, and Paul was fine, and he spoke to someone on the phone even, and the Beatles did an announcement to say he was fine, but it was just fans getting a bit hysterical.
Years later, after this supposed 1966 crash, in 1969, an anonymous caller contacted DJ Russell Gibb, a Detroit-based disc jockey hosting a live radio show on WKNR. The caller said that the Beatles were trying to cover up the death of Paul McCartney, and the evidence of his death was littered in their music and album art. This started a wildfire that still rages throughout the Beatles community to this day.
So the argument goes a bit like this. So essentially, what's thought to have happened is that in 1966, Paul McCartney and the Beatles were rehearsing or recording, and they had a really bad bust up. And Paul was so angry that he drove away in a bit of a rage and wasn't driving well and had such a bad car crash because he was so angry that he was actually decapitated. Now, at the height of Beatlemania, MI5 advised the Beatles that it would be a really bad idea to let fans know that Paul had died. Now, they feared that there would not only be mass hysteria, because the band were causing mass hysteria by just appearing places, let alone dying. Paul McCartney was at the height of his fame as well, not just within the Beatles and the Beatles fans, but within artistic circles. And he was founding a spoken word record label at the time, and he was founding art galleries, and he was so heavily involved in the artistic community. He was really at the height of his artistic powers. It would have been such a tragedy. So MI5 apparently advised the Beatles that they had to keep it covered up and that they needed to stop touring, which is what they did. And the Beatles never played again, apart from on the rooftop. They never played in front of people again. The idea was that they would replace Paul with someone who could just appear in photos on album covers.
This isn't a completely ridiculous theory. The Beatles were the biggest band of all time, and Beatlemania was a very, very real thing. When the Beatles did eventually split up, they created a hotline to help fans deal with the grief and the loss of the group. It is completely plausible that MI5 would be concerned that the loss of Paul would be so great, so tragic, and so deeply felt within the Beatles community that it would lead fans to do the unthinkable.
So the idea is that they held an audition for the best lookalike of Paul McCartney in the UK. And the guy who got the role was this Scottish guy called William Shears Campbell, or Billy Shears. Now, they then had to teach him to play like Paul, and he appeared in all the photo shoots, and he appeared on all the albums. But the Beatles' music changed direction very quickly. So they went from, you know, very poppy through to slightly soul and country roots with Rubber Soul and then Revolver. And then after Paul dies and Billy Shears joins the band, it becomes Sgt. Pepper's. And then this crazy music that they started producing. Now, the idea was that, one, the Beatles had to change their musical style because Paul was so influential in the band and they could no longer do what they used to do. And so John Lennon led the way a lot more. And two, because ultimately they had to, because they were racked with guilt and they wanted to try and find really creative ways to hide messages in their music to tell the fans that Paul was dead and they were having to do this against their will, that MI5 were actually making them hold this news back. So Beatles fans started finding clues. And I mean, there are thousands. We don't have time to go into them, but there are thousands and thousands. But I can give you a couple. One of the earliest recordings thought to have lots of clues about Paul being dead was I Am the Walrus. And it was a, there's a few things in the video that show that Paul is dead. One, that he's dressed in black, which is a common theme, that Paul is often dressed in black, or at least wearing a black flower where the other Beatles are wearing red or white flowers. So there's lots of themes in the Beatles where Paul is either wearing something black or is dressed in black where the others aren't, to indicate that he's obviously dead. Now, in I'm the Walrus, towards the end, there's a radio recording of a BBC version of King Lear, and it's about the death of Oswald. And there's a thought there that what John was trying to do was to layer in some information that someone had died. Now, it really picks up when they did Sgt. Pepper's. Now, the idea is that the album cover of Sgt. Pepper's is clearly a funeral.
If you have not seen the album cover for Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, it is a cornucopia of color and crazy. We used to have a massive copy of it framed in our hallway, and I always found it very unsettling. Regardless of any hidden messages on the cover, to me, it has a very ominous vibe to it. It does clearly look like a funeral gathering, and there are lots of strange images embedded into the art itself.
Everyone is gathered around a grave, and the grave is the flowers of the Beatles at the front, the Sgt. Pepper's bass drum with the logo on it. And then they're all gathered around. And just next to the Beatles' flowers, which is clearly where the grave is, there's what seems to be flowers arranged like a bass guitar. And the bass guitar is a left-handed bass guitar, and there's only three strings on it to indicate that there's only three Beatles left. So the funeral is for the left-handed bass guitar because Paul had died. Now, another thing is that Paul has a hand over his head. Someone behind him is holding a hand over his head. And that seemed to be a symbol of a person who's died. And if you go through a lot of Beatles photographs, particularly Magical Mystery Tour, there are so many examples where a hand is hovering over Paul's head. Now, people also notice that if you put a mirror on the bass drum, that, which is a really strange thing to do, but you put a mirror against the image of the bass drum, and what it spells is, it says I-O-N-E-I-X, he, and then a couple of little like brackets, die. So what they think there is that it says 1-9, he die, which is the date that they think that Paul might have died, which is interesting. Then in the Sgt. Pepper's booklet, Paul is wearing a patch that says OPD on it, which a lot of American fans pointed out in Britain would be officially pronounced dead. So he has a patch that says that on it. Then also in the Sgt. Pepper's, on the back of Sgt. Pepper's, Paul is standing with his back to the camera and all the other Beatles are looking forward. And that's another indication that Billy Shears had obviously had plastic surgery and they didn't want to take photos of him, but also is the Beatles symbolizing that Paul is different. Now, the other thing is in Sgt. Pepper's, the album itself, they do, after the end of Sgt. Pepper's, the song. This is quite a good one. That someone shouts, McCartney is dead, everybody, really, really dead. And if you listen to it, it's not one of the backwards recordings. It does actually sound like someone is shouting really, really dead, which is quite a good one.
Have a listen to this clip from the end of Sgt. Pepper's and tell me if you can hear a voice say, McCartney is dead, man. Really, really dead. Paul is dead. Bring him back. Bring him back. Take him back. Other spooky things to note about the Sgt. Pepper's cover is that to the left of the Fab Four in their technicolored livery are wax statues of the group when they were younger, all clad in black, looking mournfully at the grave, perhaps signifying that they are burying the old band. To the right of the four older psychedelic Beatles is a creepy old woman with an equally terrifying Shirley Temple ragdoll sitting on her lap. The doll is wearing a red and white striped sweater that states, "Welcome the Rolling Stones." The red and white stripes refer to blood and bandages, and the text is a thank you and a nod to the Rolling Stones for helping to cover up the death. Next to the doll, there is a model car, supposedly an Aston Martin, the same car Paul was driving when he was killed. The interior of the Aston is red, soaked in Paul's blood after he was decapitated. The old woman, who the doll is sitting on, is wearing an old, bloody driving glove. All indicators that Paul was fatally killed in the car crash.
Now, what then happened was the Beatles, John Lennon in particular, quite liked these rumours. And so there's two schools of thought. There's either that Paul McCartney really did die, or that the Beatles started enjoying it, because all of a sudden they went from these things that are obviously quite, you know, could have been placed by anyone, could be coincidence. You know, surely they did lots of different photos for the Sgt. Pepper's cover, and surely all the photographers weren't in on it. But then the clues start to get really clear. On a song called Glass Onion on the White Album, John Lennon sings, "Here's another clue for you all. The walrus was Paul." And a lot of fans realised that, you know, the walrus is probably a symbol of death in other cultures. And lots of people have said that the walrus is a symbol for death in Greece and also in Eskimo mythology. And so that's a real clear indication. Now, the big one that anyone who's ever heard of this would probably know of is the Abbey Road album cover. And this is where the rumours really started to pile up.
Now, if Sgt. Pepper's is the funeral for Paul McCartney, Abbey Road has infamously been dubbed as his funeral procession.
John Lennon is in white, symbolising a clergyman. Ringo's in black. He's a pallbearer or an undertaker. And George is at the back, who is the gravedigger, because he's dressed in working clothes. And Paul is a corpse because he's got no shoes on and he's walking out of step with the Beatles. He's leading with his other foot, where the Beatles lead with their left foot, and he's leading with his right foot. His eyes are closed to show that he's dead, and he's barefoot, which is another burial symbol in many cultures. And most tellingly, the cigarette that he's holding is in his right hand, where Paul McCartney is actually left-handed. So it must be Billy Shears. Then another big telling point is the number plate on the car, which is just behind the Beatles, on the Beatle car that's in the background in Abbey Road. The number plate is LMW28IF, which people think is Linda McCartney weeps, and 28 if being Paul McCartney would have been 28 if he was still alive.
We can't even begin to discuss the Paul is dead theory or any Beatles theories without addressing backmasking. Backmasking is when a message is recorded backwards on an album. When you listen to the message forwards, it just sounds like gibberish. Yet when you play it in reverse, the secret message is revealed. Beatles fans have scoured their work for these messages, and they have found some incredibly eerie connections to the Paul is dead theory. In Strawberry Fields Forever, there is a message saying, "I buried Paul." In Revolution 9, there is a line that says, "If you become naked." But when played in reverse, it states, "Satan, look at me." Perhaps showing the grief and guilt that the group has for the cover-up. The White Album is apparently filled to the brim with breadcrumbs like, "Paul, really dead. I really want out." And, "I need some wheels, get me out of here." But the most famous and chilling example of backmasking is in Revolution 9. The track begins with a voice saying, "Number 9, on loop, over and over and over again, over disembodied piano music and the tuning of a radio. But when playing backwards, it doesn't say number 9, but rather, "Turn me on, dead man."
Turn me on, dead man. 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 Turn me on, dead man.
So, you know, lots of compelling evidence, Becca. However, obviously, a lot of it absolutely crazy, but people really, really believed it. And unfortunately, Paul McCartney actually would have been 27 if he was still alive, which he was very much alive, and he was 27 when he walked across the road, Abbey Road. Linda McCartney Weeps is great, but Linda McCartney's name was actually Linda Eastman then, because her and Paul weren't married. So wouldn't have worked. And the King Lear production in I'm the Walrus, which is brilliant, is actually Ringo sat and they recorded the radio, which drove George Martin crazy. But John wanted to record the radio live and then put it in the song. And they just happened to flick on to King Lear, but they recorded lots of stuff, but they did actually go on to a King Lear piece, which John thought sounded really good. The walrus is not a symbol of death in any culture, unfortunately. And John Lennon is much more likely to be referring to him being the walrus. He was a huge Lewis Carroll fan. And the walrus and the carpenter famously lead the oysters along. So John Lennon's far more likely to be talking about him leading all the Beatles fans along, you know, potentially astray. It's much more likely to be the symbolism, if there is any, if it's not just an LSD trip and gobbledygook. And then also the other thing is the hand over Paul McCartney's head in so many photos. Again, not a symbol of death in any country at all. And it is quite interesting because the Beatles' music did drastically change just after this was meant to have happened. And Paul did start living in Scotland. But it was really interesting what happened and the way that it kicked off. And I don't think there's been a phenomenon like it in terms of someone who's clearly alive, not only clearly alive and producing art and very much doing interviews and being in the real world, where so many people believed he was actually dead and that the person was an imposter. I think John Lennon would have been a better case for it. I think they should have gone for John, because John did very drastically change during that period. He had a heroin addiction. His face really changed. He lost a lot of weight. He broke up with his wife and started going out with Yoko. So he went through a huge change at that period. Probably would have been a better candidate for someone being dead. And also, he was a terrible driver because he couldn't see. So way more likely to crash his car. So John was, I think, much more of a contender for it. But also, I think the other thing, and this is, I think, what is much, much spookier if you were after a spooky Beatles story. John Lennon's association with the number 9 is very, very spooky. So John Lennon lived, he was born on the 9th of October. He lived on 9 Newcastle Road. The Beatles were together for 9 years. John Lennon left the Beatles in 1969. He wrote a song called Revolution 9. He wrote a song called One After 909. The Beatles remasters were all released on the 9th of the 9th, 2009. On November the 9th is when John met Yoko. The 9th of February 1961 is when they first played the Cavern Club. The 9th of November 1961 is when Brian Epstein first saw them. They signed their contract to EMI on the 9th of May. Their debut single, Love Me Do, was out on Parlophone, and the code for the single was R4949. Their really like world famous appearance on Ed Sullivan was on the 9th of February. And I mean, I can go on all day with these, but some really spooky ones with that. So John Lennon, as you can imagine, because some of these were self-created, as you could probably already tell, he was obsessed with the number 9 and he thought it was hugely important. And it obviously really freaked him out when his son was born on the 9th of October, which is his birthday as well. Now, when he was shot, he was rushed to hospital on 9th Avenue. And a lot of people thought that really weird that he died on the 8th of September, considering his association with the number 9. But then people were very quick to note that actually in Liverpool, that when he died, it was actually the 9th of December.
I want to leave you with one more spooky number 9 connection. When Jim and I did this interview, he sent me over the audio file, and it came through as multiple files that were all silent. I had him resend the file, and when I opened it up, it was titled, Paul is Dead 9. I asked Jim if he added 9 to the file title, and he said no. So somewhere in cyberspace, this audio clip that you just heard accumulated a number 9. I think the reason we love urban legends so much is because they aren't totally unreasonable. These stories could be true. Urban legends validate and legitimize very real fears and concerns. And some of these stories do have a kernel of truth at the root of them. But all that sociology babble aside, I think sometimes we just like to feel scared. We like being in a setting that is safe and secure, where you're not alone, but as a group, you can go on the spooky adventure together, bonded in the fear. The scary part is once you're at home, all alone, no friends around you, and only your imagination to keep you company. Thank you for joining us on the amazing adventure that has been season one of The West London Witch. We are currently working on season two, which will be coming to you later in the summer. Follow us on Instagram and Facebook for updates on the show. And don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review so you are automatically updated when season two drops. If you have a spooky story that you would like to be featured next season, I would love to hear it. Send me an email at thewestlondonwitch@gmail.com. Thank you to all of our storytellers this season. We could not bring you the show without them. From all of us here at The West London Witch, thank you so much for your continued support this season. We can't wait to bring you the next chapter in the West London Witch anthology. Until next season, merry meet, merry part, and merry meet again. The West London Witch is created by me, Rebecca Strazina. Our sound designer and production magician is the incredible Danny Cross. Our theme music was bespokely written and performed by the wickedly talented Kyle Hall. Our cover art is the beautiful collaboration between Lizzie Wilson and Jake Bowser. Special thanks to Ms. Sinead Bowers, our quality control and biggest cheerleader. And thank you to you, all of our listeners all over the world. These are your stories. Thank you for sharing them with us.